May it please the court, Sophia Shams on behalf of the individual defendants, and I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The Supreme Court has repeated time and again that extending Bivens is a disfavored judicial activity and that Congress is better suited for recognizing new damages cause of action.
Counsel, you're doing now what you did in your briefing, which is jump to Bivens, but I guess I want to start before that. And that is, do we have jurisdictions? Are plaintiffs correct in saying that there's no jurisdiction here? And if so, what's your jurisdictionally valid qualified immunity challenge?
Sure, Your Honor. Plaintiffs are not correct about the jurisdiction. This court does have jurisdiction as it's held in different cases like Mejia and Pettibone v. Russell, for example, to assess at the motion to dismiss stage whether a complaint sufficiently alleges a claim, including the claim that an officer, as in this case CBP agents, violated clearly established constitutional rights.
So what are you claiming here, though? I wasn't exactly clear in your briefing. It seems to me that you jump to Bivens and saying, hey, this is an extension and we shouldn't do this for all the reasons you indicate. But I think we need to, before we get there, we need to establish, and that it can't be us sort of evaluating the reasonableness of certain facts.
Sure. So the reason we start with Bivens is because Bivens is the antecedent legal question, but on qualified immunity in this court's jurisdiction, our claim is that the complaint, including the video which is incorporated into the complaint, does not have sufficient allegations.
Where is it incorporated into the complaint? That was another question I guess I had. You say that, and I didn't see anywhere. Is there anywhere in the district court order that the court indicates that is incorporated?
So the district court did not rule on whether the video is incorporated or not expressly. It kind of went back and forth on that question and said it wasn't sure, but it said that even if we consider the video, it construed the video to be consistent with the complaint and the complaint's allegations. But as we've kind of stated in our brief, this court in Mayfield v. Mesa talked about how where a complaint clearly is quoting from and relying on a video, it's incorporated within the complaint, and that is what we have here. We have a complaint that has allegations that are entirely derived from the video, and so because of that, the video is incorporated into the complaint. And plaintiffs, for their part, have not provided any alternative source for where their allegations are coming from.
Counsel, let me ask you about that on the derived entirely from the video. Let's assume the video wasn't in existence, like there was no video. Would they not be able to bring this claim? I mean, could they not make the same factual arguments? Were they citing to the video? That's where I'm confused, because
they don't expressly cite the video. But again, as this court talks about in Mayfield v. Mesa, where a video is clearly quoting from and referencing, or a complaint, sorry, is quoting from and referencing a video with its allegations, the video is incorporated. And plaintiffs have, again, not disputed that that's where these allegations are coming from. And this court talks about in COJA.
I guess what I'm saying, though, is they're facts. Or, I mean, whether they're stated in a way that both parties agree, who knows? But fact, person was outside. Fact, person was taking a, you know, cell phone out of his pocket when shot. These are facts. Whether there's a video or not, could they not bring the same complaint with the same allegations? That's what I'm trying to figure out, is how important the video is. Are they saying at, you know, minute 7 in the video, it shows this?
Sure. So they can certainly bring allegations regardless of whether a video is there or not. But the point is that where their allegations are essentially summarizing a video, which as we've said here, they are, this court is well within its role to assess the video as well. And that's just how this court's judicial incorporation by reference doctrine works. As this court explained in COJA, where we have outside evidence, outside documents that a plaintiff is entirely relying on to ensure that a plaintiff is not misconstruing what those documents say. So, for example, this happens all the time in contract cases. This court can then look at those documents and materials that are incorporated into the complaint.
Well, counsel, what we said in COJA, though, is we said that we reiterate that it is improper to do so only to resolve factual disputes against the plaintiff well-pled allegations in the complaint. And so I guess the question is, does the incorporation by reference not override that fundamental rule that courts must interpret the allegation and factual disputes in favor of the plaintiffs in the pleading?
We're not disputing that standard, but I think the point in COJA that this court was making is that you know, defendants shouldn't be bringing in outside materials to then dispute facts in a complaint. That's not what we have here. Plaintiffs have incorporated by reference the video because they themselves entirely rely on the video for their allegations. And so to the extent this court looks
Counsel,
at the
your
video,
opening brief, I mean, I have one, two, three, four, like 10 references of property considered the footage shows that X, your interpretation of what the video shows, indicating later that it cannot be squared with the body camera footage that's in the video. These conclusory allegations are again directly contradicted by the body camera footage. In other words, it is, I take it, your position that the video has a contrary position. So I guess before we even get to the video, I think we have to establish whether or not it should be even incorporated.
Sure. And I just want to note that this court has jurisdiction because we have reasonable arguments, I mean, just based on Mayfield and Mesa alone, about why the video is incorporated. So to the extent this court has concerns about incorporation by reference and the qualified immunity question, you know, the antecedent Bivens legal question is fully before this court and can be resolving this case alone. But talking about incorporation by reference, the video is incorporated to the complaint because under Mayfield v. Mesa and other courts have held similarly that where a complaint is clearly quoting from and relying on a video, this court is within its jurisdiction to consider that video as part of the complaint. Now, to your point about the video contradicting allegations and whether this court can assess that, that's not a factual dispute. That's not a Johnson v. Jones issue, as plaintiffs talk about. For example, consider we have a complaint that has two back-to-back allegations that are directly contradictory. Plaintiff was wearing a red shirt, plaintiff was wearing a blue shirt, and this is material to the allegations. This court is well within its role to say these are not plausible allegations and we can disregard them because they are internally inconsistent.
And your position is, assuming we follow along, your position is that video is in fact directly contradicting
Our position is that the video reflects various contradictions with the complaint itself and provides additional context that undermines their claims. And so again, going back to the contract example I mentioned earlier, you know, where a plaintiff alleges certain aspects of a contract and says this would be a breach in their breach of contract claim, but the contract has additional context that reflects differently and otherwise, this court can consider the contract when assessing the allegations of their complaint and whether it's sufficient to state a claim. Same here. The video provides additional context and in many ways contradicts blatantly plaintiff's allegations that Mr. Mattia was fully and immediately compliant and was non-threatening. For example, the video shows that Mr. Mattia threw his sheathed knife towards the officers. He reached into his pocket despite various commands to put his hands up. He stepped back. These are all consistent with drawing a weapon and that officers were reasonably entitled to their perception that he was facing an immediate threat of harm.
Well, counsel, again, reasonable minds may differ on that, and that's sort of the problem here, though, because we're supposed to interpret those facts in light most favorable to the plaintiff here.
So I think if this court is clear as to what the video shows, which is as the facts that I've described, that he was not complying with the commands to put his hands up and instead put his hand in his pocket, turned away, and then pulled it out really quickly as if to be drawing a weapon. And if this court has any concern about, you know, whether that raises a reasonable threat of harm or not, I think that weighs in favor of qualified immunity because officers in this context are making split-second judgments and have to deal with the facts as they're unfolding before them in very quick situations. And the Supreme Court has said we have to give breathing room in this context to officers that are faced with these situations. But again, even if this court is having concerns about qualified immunity, we think the antecedent Bivens question is extremely clear in this case and that the district court definitely erred on that area. And so I would like to talk about that, which is that this case is far afield.
Sorry,
of Bivens.
Before you go there, I want to ask you a few more questions, I guess, factually about this knife thing and the tossing it. If I remember correctly, I believe that the complaint described it differently, correct?
Like an underhanded toss.
Underhanded, yes. Toss. And so are you telling us the video does not show that the toss was underhanded?
So, I mean, I think what the video shows is that he throws the item towards the officers.
Was it an underhanded toss?
I think it shows that he throws it. I think.
Okay, but was the throw underhand? I don't know why that's such a difficult question to respond to. Was it underhand? Was it thrown in an underhand manner?
By the way, counsel, we have all seen the video.
Yeah. Sure. Yes. I mean,
No secret here.
I think, you know, we stand by what we said in our brief, which is that the video shows that he throws it. But if this court has ambiguities about whether it's an underhanded toss or a throw, I think the larger point is that it was not threatening, and that is blatantly contradicted. Because when you have a weapon and you put it in the air so high towards officers. I mean, you can see in the video, officers immediately withdraw their weapons because they perceive this to be a threat of harm. And so I think the point that we're making...
So yes or no on underhanded toss?
We characterize it in our brief as throwing the sheath knife.
Was it thrown underhanded or no?
I can't say. I think the throwing is how we're characterizing it, and that's just how the characterization is in the brief, and we stand by that. To the extent this court wants to construe it as underhanded or not, this court can look at the video and determine that for itself.
I guess you're making my point, is you're asking us to look at facts and find the facts differently than the district court. And I know that we can if there's blatant contradictions. This is not showing me a blatant contradiction.
Sure. I think if this court wants to look at blatant contradictions, it should look at the fact that they describe him as not threatening, and we believe that the video shows otherwise for the reasons I've described. It talks about him being fully compliant, and he did not comply with commands to get on the ground or to put his hands up. In fact, he put his hand in his pocket despite not being told to do so. We think those are clear blatant contradictions that this court can look at for qualified immunity to the extent this court has questions about the blatant contradictions. But on Bivens, again, this case can be answered on Bivens and Bivens alone, which is that this is not a new context. This is entirely a new context because it's far afield from Bivens. As we've explained in our brief, Bivens was a warrantless search and seizure by Federal Narcotics Bureau officers. And here we have a deadly force case involving CBP agents that were on tribal land assisting tribal law enforcement 1 mile from the border. That itself makes this an entirely new context, and there are special factors that certainly warrant counseling against Bivens in this case. I think the district court's analysis was clearly off base based on how this court and the Supreme Court have treated these types of Bivens cases, looking at a variety of factors. Even small differences can be meaningful in this respect. And so to the extent there's any concern about qualified immunity and whether the video is incorporated or not, we think Bivens and Bivens alone is a basis on which this court can reverse, as it's done in Mejia, in Pettibone, in Chambers, and likewise. If there are no further questions, I'm happy to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Ryan Stitt on behalf of appellees, plaintiffs. The court should affirm the district court's decision on multiple bases. First and foremost, to address the jurisdictional question before this court. This court lacks jurisdiction to address the Bivens question at this juncture, given the fact that the qualified immunity argument that appellants raise clearly turns on disputed issues of fact that this court is not equipped to resolve at this stage of the case. Questions like whether the throw was underhanded, questions that appellants need to convince this court as a matter of fact that the throw was threatening, that the weapon was, it's still an imminent threat when officers later shot Ray Mattia. They need to turn compliance into noncompliance, and they need to turn a cell phone, which I think everyone in this courtroom has in their pocket right now, into a perceived weapon. Those questions of fact are not properly before the court.
But is that really a dispute over fact or over the legal significance of the fact? I mean, looking at this, and it's obviously a tragic case here, but it seems like what happened was the officers misconstrued. I mean, Mr. Mattia didn't do anything wrong. They tell him, take your hands out of your pocket. So he complies, but he has a cell phone and, you know, probably not thinking much, just pulled it out. And the officers thought that cell phone in his hand was a weapon, a gun, and shot him. So, I mean, isn't that more of a legal significance of the facts rather than a dispute over the facts? If a question of whether he pulled out the phone or not, that would be a dispute over the facts. But I think it's undisputed that he did take the phone out when they told him to take your hands out. Again, it's not his fault, I don't think. You know, when police officers surround you and are screaming at you, you probably just react. But I mean, I'm not sure if this is a dispute of fact.
I respectfully disagree, and I would turn the court to this court's decision in Marsh, as well as Torres, and as well as look at Scott versus Harris, a Supreme Court decision. Whether an officer reasonably used force is a factual question, and this court resolves those questions on a totality of the circumstances basis. And so to say that it really doesn't matter entirely as a question of fact exactly what happened, I think subsumes this totality of the circumstances, fact-driven inquiry, into one that is overly abstract and not, I think, tethered to the individual facts of the case, which this court and the Supreme Court decisions have been consistent on, the Graham versus Connor factors. Again, it's a totality of the circumstances question that this court needs to analyze. And at the 12B6 stage, that places an enormous burden on the plaintiffs to present a factual scenario in the complaint to then have the defendants produce an edited and untested, incomplete and redacted body camera sort of compilation, and then argue to this court that it should resolve disputed issues of fact in its favor based on its own edited version of a video that they've killed the only other witness that's a non-law enforcement officer to the interaction. That places the plaintiffs in an impossible position. The court addressed this in part in COJA. I would turn the court...
I guess the question here is, I guess, the threshold question of jurisdiction. Do we have jurisdiction here? And then there's the merits of the qualified immunity. Seems like maybe do have jurisdiction because there's no real dispute of what happened. But the significance of these facts maybe means there's no, you know, we can't decide qualified immunity. But, you know, I think there are two separate questions, I guess, the jurisdiction part and the ultimate merits of the qualified immunity claim.
I don't entirely bisect it in the way that I think the court is doing based on its question. And again, I would turn the court to this court's decision in Marsh. The question in Marsh was during a traffic stop whether the driver of the automobile was reaching for the shifter, which I understand to be sort of from reading the opinion in between the two front seats, and whether the driver had his hand on the shifter or was reaching for the shifter, or alternatively was going for potentially a weapon under the front passenger seat. The highway patrol officer, rather, I think perceived the latter, that the driver was reaching for a weapon under the seat and fired. And the factual question of whether the officer reasonably perceived that based on a totality of the circumstances analysis at the summary judgment phase, so after discovery, depositions, and a far more complete record compared to the 12B6 stage we find ourselves here today, ruled as a jurisdictional matter that Jones controlled, and that was asking this court to engage in a fact-driven review of contested material facts that are properly addressed at trial and not in the Court of Appeals. That is where we find ourselves today, even more in an even more advanced stage, given the 12B6 posture and the edited body camera footage that appellants seek to have this court review.
Counsel, let me actually bring you back to the body footage since we're talking about that. Was it incorporated by reference?
It's quoted. But I don't believe that that's the same as incorporating it by reference. And the body camera footage in Mayfield, the body camera footage in Scott versus Harris is uncontested. And if I can turn the court to page 1104 of the Mayfield decision and quote, it says, "And because Mayfield has never contended that the video footage is inaccurate or unreliable, we view the facts in the light most favorable by the videotape." That's quoting Scott versus Harris. Again, Scott versus Harris also had a video of the incident that was essentially a complete video that neither party argued was unreliable, edited, or incomplete for some reason. The court then treated it as incorporated by reference because it was cited in the complaint and reviewed it. Here, it's distinct. While we quote from sections of the body camera footage, the complaint does draw on other sources of information. While the Bivens claim is what's presented by appellants before the court at this stage, there are other state law claims that rely on other sources of information. For example, Raymond Mattia's sister, Annette Mattia, lives in the home that was next door to Ray's house, and she was home at the time the shots were fired. She has filed an intentional infliction of emotional distress claim under Arizona law that is ongoing. Obviously, the portions of the complaint that rely on her percipient observations and the fact that she was present are untethered from the body camera footage. So when appellants say that the complaint entirely relies on the body cam footage, that's selective and inaccurate, and again, highlights for this court the difficulty of of adjudicating these fact-driven questions at this juncture in the case. It's just
In what way do you think it's selective and inaccurate?
The body camera footage?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Well, I don't have the entire record before me. I mean, discovery is still ongoing. The district court has bisected or you know, allowed us to continue with the discovery phase, but we're not complete with discovery. And so I haven't, for example, deposed the officers who fired other percipient witnesses, engaged with a forensic videographer to go through the complete body camera footage and to conclusively answer your question. I mean, what we can see in the footage that we've all viewed is that it's edited, that it's a selection of clips from different body camera feeds, that it's redacted in parts where the officers are talking about what they're doing there, what they're looking for. Those are indications that at this stage, that body camera footage is not reliable. And it's certainly not a conclusive record of entirely what happened. It's different from Mayfield. It's different from Scott, where the body camera footage comprised the unobjectionable facts of what happened. And the court was able to determine in, for example, a traffic incident, whether the light is yellow or the light is green is an objective fact that this court can watch the video and determine. Here, it's more complicated. Whether the knife is thrown underhanded is one of just many disputed factual issues that are properly addressed by a trier of fact, not by a court of appeals, in particular at the 12B6 stage. I think what appellants are doing, quite transparently, in fact, is looking to raise a qualified immunity argument that has very little chance of success on the merits just to get the Bivens claim or the Bivens issue before this court at the earliest possible opportunity. This court should not grant them that opportunity. They don't have jurisdiction to raise the Bivens claim at this opportunity, at this juncture in the case. And plaintiffs need a fair opportunity to go through discovery and to properly and completely understand the record before this court reviews the Bivens question, which it clearly will review later in the case.
Counsel, I'm going to ask you to address your friend on the other side's contention that the footage blatantly contradicts the amended complaint.
It clearly doesn't. The district court made that factual finding. The district court reviewed the body camera footage, assuming arguendo that it was incorporated by reference into the complaint, and made that finding a fact already. Again, this it simply doesn't. Ray Mattia tossed the hunting knife underhanded to the officer. To play devil's advocate, if he had dropped it at his feet, I think that we would see the appellants say that he still had access to it. It was still within his sphere of influence. He could have reached and picked it up. And so the knife maintained its dangerous, you know, use as a weapon. The fact that he threw it underhanded and did so in a nonviolent, non-threatening way to the officer removes a factor that the court could look to find an imminent threat. He was compliant. He took his hand out of his pocket when instructed. He was given conflicting instructions as well, you know. And so I think that the body camera footage doesn't contradict the complaint, much less blatantly contradict the complaint. The district court made that finding of fact. It is the proper forum for the government to have raised that argument at this juncture. It is not available for interlocutory review at this point, given that it's a question of fact. Jones controls on that issue, as well as Marsh being instructive, even at the summary judgment phase. If I could briefly turn to address the Bivens question, if the court elects to address that issue, although our primary point is that the court lacks jurisdiction to address the Bivens question at this time. This court has, as well as other circuits, has upheld Fourth Amendment claims against Border Patrol officers. That does not raise a new context. This court in Chavez versus United States at 683 F3rd 1102 and other circuits as well have upheld Fourth Amendment claims against Border Patrol officers. And the Fourth Amendment claim is germane to the Bivens case itself. That too was a Fourth Amendment question. Here, what's distinct from Egbert and Hernandez is that Border Patrol agents were not engaged in their duties of interdicting undocumented people coming across the border or narcotics coming across the border. The issues presented in Hernandez and Bivens naturally touched on international relations, as the court held, because Border Patrol's mandate involves controlling the border and those who cross it.
All right, but the Supreme Court has set a very, very high bar for extending Bivens. I mean, we've been overruled 9-0 in Egbert, and I think they focus on the fact there was a CBP officer in that case, whereas Bivens was a precursor, I think, to the ATF. And they even said the rank of an officer is a difference. I mean, it's a very, very high bar to extend Bivens.
I understand the court. Judge Lee, I understand your point. I would argue two points in response. First, I don't believe it's extending Bivens. Bivens addressed the Fourth Amendment. Egbert, for example, sought to extend liability to the First Amendment claim, which was part of the claim in Egbert. And I would turn to the Supreme Court's decision in Abisi, which is, simply from 2017, so not that old. And it said, quote, "It must be understood that this opinion is not intended to cast doubt on continued force or even the necessity of Bivens in the search and seizure context of which it arose. This case falls squarely within the Fourth Amendment context in which Bivens arose. Border Patrol agents are alleged in the complaint to have been engaged in general law enforcement, not law enforcement related to interdicting alien smuggling like Egbert, not Border Patrol law enforcement activity like securing the border in Hernandez with the cross-border shooting. It's distinct.
They're still near the border. They're working with tribal authorities. You see the examples the court says that it's a distinction. I mean, it's just minor little things. I mean, the rank of the officer is a material difference, which seems pretty extreme, but that's what the Supreme Court said. So, I mean, it seems like a long shot here.
I respectfully disagree. I mean, the proximity to the border, I think, is a red herring in this context because we need to look at what Border Patrol was actually doing. If they're engaged in general law enforcement, if the FBI searches someone's home improperly, comparable to a circumstance in Bivens, does it matter that that person lives in San Diego as opposed to San Francisco, given the proximity to the border? I think the answer would hopefully be no. And I think the proximity to the border is just not the overarching factor. The issue is what they were there to do. Were they engaged in interdicting illegal alien smuggling like in Egbert? Were they engaged in a cross-border shooting that plainly implicated national security concerns as in Hernandez? The answer is no. And so if the court elects to reach the Bivens question at this juncture, it should deny on that basis as well.
Great. Thank you.
So a couple points, Your Honors. I'd like to begin with jurisdiction. On jurisdiction, we're not asking the court to assess whether any of these facts are true or not. What we're asking the court to do is what it has done time and again at the motion to dismiss stage for qualified immunity and look at the complaint, which incorporates the video because it quotes from the video, as I've stated, and ask whether there's any internal inconsistencies. Now, the court may disagree with us about that. That's fine. But that's not a jurisdictional issue. That's a merits issue. And so then we ask on the antecedent legal question whether there's Bivens. And here it's clear that this is a new context to which Bivens does not extend. I mean, this is not Bivens. This is a case where we have CBP agents assisting with tribal law enforcement on tribal land 1 mile from the international border. That is various factors that make this case entirely new from Bivens with various special factors that counsel against Bivens. Plaintiffs have talked about how it's about what they're going to do or what they were doing at that time. It's not. The Supreme Court has told us this resolves to a single question, whether there's any reason to think that Congress is better equipped at recognizing a damages cause of action. And here we have plenty of reasons. So we think it's very clear on the Bivens issue that, the district court erred in its assessment of Bivens. I want to talk a little bit on the video by incorporation by reference issue. I think there's a little bit of confusion here. They did not contest video incorporation below. I think these are arguments that the district court kind of raised in its opinion, but from my understanding of the briefing below, this was not contested below. There's been some discussion about how there might be new sources of where these allegations came from. This is the first time that we've heard of it in briefing. Again, this was not raised below. And then additionally, it's been acknowledged that the complaint is quoting from the video itself. And so as we've talked about with COJA, it can't be that plaintiffs are now quoting a video and then asking this court, don't look at the video.
Counsel, is the video edited?
The video has certain edits, I think that's true, but plaintiffs have not brought in as to how that questions the authenticity of the events. And certainly the portion of the relevant events here, the shooting itself, is not edited. That's a clear path that we have. And so I don't think
what was the reason the video was edited? Is it just for brevity? Is it
I can't say to why the video was edited in certain ways. What I can say is that the relevant portions were not edited, and plaintiffs have not drawn any connection to how it's edited, maybe, and whether that calls into question the authenticity. And so I think that's an important point. And then lastly, what I want to say is this relation to Marsh and things like Johnson v. Jones. As we've explained in our brief, Ashcroft, I think, completely forecloses this question. Under Johnson v. Jones, that just does not apply to questions at the motion to dismiss stage. And so Marsh from this court was a summary judgment issue. Johnson v. Jones was a summary judgment issue. Those involved factual disputes. And as I've explained before, we are not asking this court to assess any facts on its face, left or right, or true or false. What we're asking this court to do is do what it's always done time and again and ask whether in the complaint there are sufficient allegations to state a claim. And then it can move on to the Bivens question. And for the reasons I've discussed, that warrants reversal. If there are no further questions, we'd ask that this court reverse.
Great. Thank you. Thank you both for the helpful argument. The case is submitted, and we are recessed for the day.